This is Vermont Edition. I'm Jane Lindholm. If a big solar farm is going up in your community, what role, right, responsibility should community members and your town's elected officials have in determining whether or not that project gets built? How much say should towns have in the size and scope of renewable energy projects being built within their boundaries? And how do we create a fair system for all Vermonters, meeting our energy needs, following the state's laid out goals for renewable energy, but also respecting the needs and desires of small communities? Legislators are grappling with those questions at the State House this year. One of the bills they've been working on, S-230, is an energy siting bill that attempts to figure out that right balance. The bill has passed the Senate, and it's being debated in House committee, where it's already had some changes made. Today, we're going to talk with two legislators who have a role in this discussion. Senator Chris Bray is chair of the Senate Natural Resources and Energy Committee, and Representative Tony Klein is chair of the House Natural Resources and Energy Committee. Thanks to both of you for taking some time out today to have a conversation with us.
Happy to be here.
Yeah, thank you, Jane.
And I understand this is the subject of debate in your committee today, Representative Klein. So it's an all-day thing that you are steeped in this at the very moment?
For the bill to eventually get to the governor's desk, it needs to be out of my committee by the end of the day today.
And will it be?
It will.
So you will be voting it out one way or another?
Yes, we will.
Let's talk about the main focus and the aim of this bill, and then we can get into some of the differences and some of the sort of philosophical areas where there's disagreement, perhaps not among you two, but within our community of listeners, we're hearing a lot of it today. So, Senator Bray, why don't you tell us the main focus and aim of this bill as you passed it?
Sure. So this bill really started last year when the siting conversations came up as part of passing the Renewable Energy Standard Bill. And we created a working group that met over the summer and fall to bring recommendations to the legislature. And all those recommendations were rolled into S-230. The most important thing we're doing in that bill is that Vermonters have strongly supported the move to renewables, but how we get there is where there's some difference of opinion. And what we're doing in the bill is we're giving Vermonters a greater voice in making the choices about how we make the move to renewables.
And by giving Vermonters a greater voice, do you mean through the communities, through actual town processes? And so it's sort of through the town structure that Vermonters have a greater voice?
Exactly. So right now we have town plans and we have regional plans, and the state has for many decades been responsible for energy development. And their energy development has land use impacts, especially as we start building out things like wind and solar. We didn't integrate land use planning, which is carried out at the municipal and local level, and state energy planning. So the important bridge that S-230 makes is it links energy development with land use planning.
There were many amendments made right at the end of the process in the Senate. And can you lay out a couple of other things that the bill that you passed does?
Sure. I mean, so the crucial element of it is this integrated planning element. But we also, over the last couple of years, heard Vermonters repeatedly say, you know, there are places we'd like to see these things. For instance, parking lots and rooftops and landfills and
for solar panels.
For solar panels, for instance. And so we created a category called preferred locations. And then we asked the Public Service Board to create incentives through their programs to help cite more projects in preferred locations. And municipalities have a role in designating preferred locations as well.
So, Representative Klein, you're looking at this bill now. It passed the Senate. It's in House committee. And as you said, needs to get out today if it's going to actually reach the House floor and if it's going to pass or get through the system this legislative session. Do you agree with the main aim and focus here? And is that the way you see the crux of the issue?
I agree. We agree with that in our committee. And Senator Bray and his committee really did an excellent job in teeing up the issue. And we had the benefit of watching what they went through, and we heard all the critiques and the moaning and the complaining. And so we have the benefit of seeing where the sticking points were and what people were suggesting that we could make it better, and that's what we're working on. And basically, it's come on, folks, let's simplify this and let's make it doable. So the two major issues that are in the bill is absolutely getting the town's voice to substantial deference before the Public Service Board. And we've taken the basic framework of what Senator Bray's committee has done, and we've just simplified it and made it so that it's not a five-year process. It can be as quick as the town can get their stuff together. With some checks and balances and appeal processes if necessary, but it gets a town to the position at the board of substantial deference, which means basically that a developer really has to show why that town plan is not appropriate instead of the other way around. The second major piece that we've heard about or have heard a lot of loud stuff about is wind turbine sound, okay? And we have we are finalizing on we're taking the groundwork that Senator Bray's committee gave, and we are going to require the Public Service Board by rule, which is a very comprehensive and open to the public process, to set the standards and create the rules for wind turbine sound going forward. They will do it both on standard going forward and also by case by case basis.
And the difference between what's happening now and that is that right now it's just a case-by-case basis.
Right now it's just a case-by-case. And the other thing that we have made sure to do, there are a couple of projects that are thinking about going forward. We have in this bill, we put an application date in. It's already passed. So any project that puts in an application after April 15th, and nobody put it in before April 15th, will be subject to these new standards.
Assuming the bill passes.
The bill will pass.
Okay. We're talking today about renewable energy siting, and we're looking at how much input local communities should have and what kind of form that input should take. Listeners, I'd love to have your take, and you have not been shy this morning in sending us notes and telling us where you stand on this. How do you balance the energy needs of the state with your personal ideas about renewable energy siting? Should a town be able to say no big projects anywhere within our boundaries in their town energy plan? What's the right fit for getting municipalities involved and making sure the state is working in everyone's best interests? Our number is 1-800-639-2211. That's 1-800-639-2211. Or you can post a note on the Vermont Edition page at vpr.net. A couple of notes that have come in so far. Mark says, we need a system that enables towns to collaborate with their utilities to develop good generation projects in the right places. Senator Bray, your bill does not accomplish this. It leaves achievement of our goals to the energy developers who are running roughshod over our communities. Your bill ensures that the backlash against Vermont's energy policy will continue to grow. JDB says, why should towns be expected to give up their zoning authority for projects that aren't in any way in the public good for Vermont? As long as the recs for these projects continue to be sold out of state, as the vast majority of them are, including the so-called community solar arrays, they don't provide renewable energy for Vermonters and should be treated like any other for-profit commercial enterprise subject to municipal zoning. Annette Smith, executive director of Vermonters for a Clean Environment, says the better question is how can we work together to develop real renewable energy for Vermont? It's not just about how towns weigh in. It's about building community, meeting our energy needs, and being smart about our choices. The system currently in place enriches developers, utilities, and wealthy people who offset tax liabilities. Vermont's scenic beauty and community interests are being degraded. On the other side of the equation, Luke Reed says the biggest concerns we hear about renewable energy projects are from people who don't like where they're being put. S-230 gives communities a say in where those projects go and mostly does it in a smart way, although the amendments that would take away the state's power to make the final decision and that would charge Vermonters a fee for renewable energy are a bad idea. A version of this bill that fixes those amendments would improve things for everyone except for people who are opposed to Vermont generating its own renewable energy. And one more here, and then I'll get back to you guys. We have a lot of them. John says, concerning large-scale wind power, we should first consider places where the landscape is already compromised, like bridges, ski slopes, and high power lines. Other locations should meet a zoning criteria, including distance from neighbors. I go by four large turbines on a nearby mountain every day. I don't find them objectionable. It feels like we're using a resource that's already there waiting to be harnessed. If the same negative feelings about wind were in control, say, 100 years ago, where would we be today in terms of railroads, superhighways, and high power lines? So Representative Klein mentioned this phrase, substantial deference, and this is something that the Public Service Board would have to consider, would have to look at town plans in the zoning process when a developer wants to build a large scale or, you know, a somewhat large scale renewable energy project. What do towns have to do to get this substantial deference before the board? Senator Bray?
Sure. So, you know, I'll have to see how the House version emerges. But in essence, we asked the regional planners and the town planners to engage in a process to develop a renewable energy plan for the region and for the town. And the idea is to have we don't tell anyone how to do things, but to find their own way to participate in Vermont meeting its overall renewable energy goals. The most commonly cited one is to see Vermont become 90% renewable by 2050, although we lay out statutory goals in the bill as well. And the way a town would do that is they bring their plan to the Regional Planning Commission. The Regional Planning Commission, they already certify town plans. They would be looking at the renewable energy component of it. If it's certified, that means they're basically in harmony with the overall state goals. And a town plan that is certified in that way, when it came before the Public Service Board, would be given substantial deference. And under the current rules, they're given due consideration. So if you think about it, this is a teeter-totter. Right now, it's the town is on the, I'd say, they are not as influential as they'd like to be. If you're given substantial deference, the teeter-totter tips, and now the town is actually going, I think, will prevail in those cases. And it's going to take they're going to have a very high threshold to override that town plan. They would have to supply clear and convincing evidence that there is a public good so great that the town plan should be overridden.
And so this is assuming a sort of a contentious situation where a developer says, I want to build this project, and the town is saying this doesn't fit with our town energy plan or doesn't fit in the scope that it's been proposed.
Exactly, exactly. And, you know, you mentioned the word contentious. So these sorts of cases, I think a lot of Vermonters would be surprised to know that there's over 5,000 net metering installations in the state already. And the vast majority of those are not contentious. But, of course, there are some that are. And those are the ones that we tend to hear about, and they're the ones that come up to the Public Service Board.
So, Representative Klein, this idea of a town energy plan being a component in the Public Service Board hearings and a town getting substantial deference, a town would have to show that it was still working within the state's goal of renewable energy. And so a town couldn't say, look, we don't have any space where it's appropriate to build a large solar array or to put in wind turbines. That's in our energy plan. We just don't have the place for it. That would not be an acceptable town energy plan, or would it?
That would actually be an acceptable town plan. I'll give you an example of the town of Warren. Okay, and town of Warren has two ridge lines there.
This is in the Mad River Valley.
Yes, I'm sorry, in the Mad River Valley. And it's an iconically beautiful place and a tourist town and all that good stuff. There are two ridge lines. One is on federal land, which makes it absolutely problematic. The other ridge line has already been tested for whether there's an adequate wind resource, and there isn't. So in their town plan, they actually say that wind is not appropriate. And why that's okay is that within the regional plan, there's still an accommodation for that technology to be somewhere to meet the conditions of the region's plan and the state's plan. And that is the big difference. The other big difference is that we are adding the energy planning component to town plans. It's voluntary. They don't have to do it. But if they want to do it and they want to get this substantial deference, which is a big deal, then they will be working with the Department of Public Service to make sure that their energy plan is in compliance with the state's plans and the Regional Planning Commission's plans as well. So there's coordination. And
so the Department of Public Service, does it have to sign off on a town's plan?
Yes, and we're struggling with the correct word. We don't want to make it certification and things like that, but it is kind of a sign off. Yes, you've done the correct. So, and the key thing is that the town can work as quickly and as hard as they want to get to this substantial deference level.
So, you know, we've heard from the Public Service Board that it says, you know, we acknowledge that towns feel like they haven't had enough of a role, and that is an issue, and it's one that we're trying to correct without this legislation. So, could this be done without a bill passed by the legislature? Couldn't you both step back and say, let's see what the Public Service Board decides to do, Representative Klein?
So last October, I wrote a letter to the Public Service Board because I got tired of hearing the chair of the Public Service Board say, we're just doing what the legislature tells us to do. If you don't like what we're doing, go talk to them. And I cited in the letter the broad statutory authority that they already have. For example, there's nothing in the statutes that says they can't provide good customer service, okay? And that's been a big problem. To their credit at this point, they are hearing. And I think that they are beginning to change. I noticed that they are issuing press releases again explaining why they do and do not do things. They haven't done that in 12 years. I'm very, very hopeful.
And Margaret Cheney testified before your committee,
yes,
right, saying,
yes,
we are aware of this issue, we're
exactly
working on it.
Yes.
And she's a member of the Public Service
and
Board.
I am sure within their offices, they are going to have somebody answering the phone who can answer questions. So I think that would be a vast improvement.
Well, so then why do we need your bill?
Well, we do need the bill so that when a contested case comes before the board, they have specific guideline now that the town does get this enhanced position. And it basically makes the developer prove why the town plan is not adequate as opposed to the other way around.
Senator Bray?
Yeah, you know, there's a so-called Rutland resolution that approximately 130 Vermont towns have signed on to, saying we want, you know, the elected officials in these towns are saying we want a greater voice. And we hear that. We respect that point of view. And we want to create an explicit pathway for them to have that greater voice, not just hope that the Public Service Board will be, you know, listening to them.
Your own town, the town of New Haven, is one of the towns that is sort of a center of debate for how siting should work and some frustration. Do you think that townspeople in New Haven and your elected town representatives are going to be happy with this legislation?
I think some will be happy, some won't. I suppose New Haven is, because of its location, we happen to be near a very large substation. There's very robust three-phase power, and that provides the physical infrastructure that makes it, and then lots of open, relatively flat fields. So we're kind of an ideal spot for solar, and it's made us a bit of a magnet for projects. Change is difficult. People are very used to looking at the landscape and not seeing it change much at all, and if so, quite slowly. So I think we are going through some growing pains, but the law, I think, provides a very clear and positive role. I guess, you know, the way I look at it, we're talking about changing our the way we generate electricity and use it for decades to come. Right now, we have much too much conflict, in my opinion. Vermonters very broadly, poll after poll shows strong support for renewables. But if you talk to individuals, there's individual projects they don't like. So I feel like without this bill, we leave people in the lurch. We've helped create the demand for renewable projects. I think Vermonters support having them. But how they get developed, where they get developed, we need to deliver an answer. And S-230 is that answer.
More to come on this legislation that would spell out a little more clearly how local communities can be involved in determining what kinds of energy projects are located where in their towns. A lot of you have thoughts on this issue. We'll get to your calls and more of your emails coming up. Our number is 1-800-639-2211 or post on the Vermont Edition Facebook page. I'm Jane Lindholm, and this is Vermont Edition. We're looking at the role local communities should play in energy siting moving forward in Vermont. It can be a contentious issue among Vermonters. We're talking with Representative Tony Klein, chair of the House Natural Resources and Energy Committee, and Senator Chris Bray, chair of the Senate Natural Resources and Energy Committee. And if you have a comment, leave it on the Vermont Edition Facebook page or call 1-800-639-2211. Again, that's 1-800-639-2211. Ken in Windham says, I own a second home in Windham that's been in my family for nearly 50 years. I enjoyed it as a boy, as a student at UVM, and still do now as a gray-haired man with children of my own. I am beyond dismayed by the prospects of towering, noisy wind turbines next to my yard. But apparently, since I don't vote in Vermont, I have no way to voice my opposition. This is indeed taxation without representation. I do not know how this could be more unfair. And Elizabeth in Middletown Springs says, towns must have a primary role in the rulemaking and permitting process for siting renewable energy projects. The legislature and state governance need to move away from a presently held attitude that towns cannot be trusted in making decisions about the siting of these projects. In their roles as decision makers and planners and creators of town plans, town officials and planners are much more in tune with economic, environmental, and energy issues on the local level than state lawmakers are or ever can be. Therefore, town plans and rules should be the primary determinant in siting decisions and the basis for state-level decisions and legislation about renewable energy siting. Lauren says, I very much believe that this bill is trying to protect the long-term health of the Vermont landscape by encouraging the development of renewable energy. Community engagement has to be a big part in that, and by allowing towns to set their own standards for the development, the people are given a voice. I also think it's important that there's the possibility for projects to be pushed through that may not have been passed that will benefit the larger whole. Overall, I'm excited to see how S-230 will allow a new sustainable energy system to flourish. My concern is that there will be major last-minute amendments that could ultimately slow the process of renewable energy development in the state. Let's go to Paul, calling in from Grand Isle. Hi, Paul. Go ahead.
Hi. I'm wondering who owns the hundreds of thousands of acres that are located within the medians of I-89 and I-91. I don't know why we don't fill that up with solar panels and wind turbines. It's accessible year-round. It's already ugly. There's all kinds of noise there already. And any of the erosion problems have been solved decades ago.
Paul, thanks for your call. Appreciate that. Representative Klein, what about that, putting solar panels in the medians on 89? Is that state land?
I have no idea. But you have to locate a distributed generation near three-phase power lines because its end use is closer to the generation source, so it doesn't travel on the big transmission line. So you can't just plunk it anywhere because it doesn't make financial sense. So I understand the frustrations of the caller. A lot of people say, why can't you put the wind projects here and there? Wind projects go where the wind resource is. And then, fortunately or unfortunately in Vermont, they happen to be high in the mountaintops.
We have another listener from Windham who wants to weigh in. Daniel's on the line with us. Hi, Daniel. Go ahead. Hi, Daniel. Are you there?
I'm here.
Hi. Go right ahead.
Well, thank you for the opportunity to speak. I live in Windham, Vermont. The majority of our town is against the windmills. Nobody wants 500-foot towers with red blinking lights on them. It's going to affect our bears and our moose and our pristine wildlife. But if they get basically handed to us that we don't have any choice about it, we'd like some choice about the setting of the windmills and how they're going to affect us and the noise levels that are going to affect us. I think that Senator Chris Bray and Representative Tony Klein are trying to find some answers, but it's nice that the Democratic Party has taken an initiative to push this through, but the majority of the people don't want it. And if we have to live with it, we would like a say, a direct say, in the placements of it.
So, Daniel, is what you're hearing about this bill, would that be enough to assuage your concerns?
very much so. I'm hearing that the S-230 was being passed with all of our considerations with it, and then it got turned around and passed as it stood with no considerations or no town say whatsoever, and now it's being enforced through. And our federal tax dollars are paying the subsidies that are building these things. Now, Vermont, they keep saying it's going to improve Vermont's fossil fuel standing, and Vermont has one shipper plant in the entire state. Everything is hydroelectric or is imported from Canada. So we don't have a fossil fuel impact if we convert from what we're doing to windmills. I you know, right now, windmills are going to have something like 300-foot bases of concrete to hold them up. Cement plants have to be put into our mountains to build the bases for these towers.
Well, Daniel, I take your point, and let me hand it over to Senator Chris Bray, because, you know, Daniel's obviously frustrated by the situation, but also looking at some of the benefits of your legislation.
Sure. So I think, you know, Representative Klein and his committee has done a great job on addressing very explicitly and proactively the sound issue. And I think when Daniel studies the bill as it comes out, and I imagine it will shortly, I think he'll find reassuring work there. But to the point of Vermont being so green that we don't need to be developing renewables, I think one of the things that I've learned over the last couple of years is that Vermont is, we don't have our own grid. We're part of the New England grid. And 85% of the time, Vermont appears within that grid as a load to be served by out-of-state generation. So whenever we add green energy to the grid, although that generating station that's burning gas or oil someplace else, it may not be located in Vermont, but we push green energy into the grid, our load size decreases, and some plant elsewhere in New England backs down. They don't run it as much. So we have a positive environmental impact, even though some of the generating stations that support us are not located in Vermont. And it's not easy. This is a big thing for me to learn, has been to look at regional generation, and Vermont's part of the region. And so when we look at Vermont laws and Vermont projects, we need also to reconcile it against the system that we live in as an integrated, comprehensive electrical system.
Well, and not just what we can push onto the grid, but what we need the grid for. I mean, we're still looking at problems with baseload power.
Right.
With all of these renewable energy projects, do you see an end to that reliance on some other source, some less green source in the future?
You know, I'd say it sounds melodramatic to say we're in the midst of an energy revolution, but I think it really is true. We are literally day by day how we generate power, how we use power, what we're using that power for. I mean, for instance, right now there are 1,000 electric vehicles in Vermont. It's my hope that a decade from now we'll see 100,000 electric vehicles in Vermont, that more and more people will be using electricity to heat their homes. So there's a lot going on, and you know, it's a work in progress. We're figuring it out. But I think the encouraging thing to me is there are a lot of people who bring a genuine desire to come together, to plan things, to figure things out, and to move forward. On our whiteboard in the committee, it says, start with yes. And I'd say a lot of Vermonters feel that way. Let's start with yes. How do we come together? How do we figure these things out? How do we move forward? Vermont is not all that oriented, I'd say, to, you know, the word no.
You know, it really what has bothered me most as a legislator is people who are genuinely upset and pained and hurt, and I have to tell you, as a legislator, it has not been fun being the brunt of a lot of accusation, whether it's well deserved or not. That I'll leave that up to the individuals. But there's a lot of misinformation out there. This is not, you know, electricity in the grid is very complex, very technical, not easy. It's why I love it. It's so interesting. I feel like I'm in grad school. But there are no easy answers, and the easy solutions just don't exist. But here's what I'm reminded of. I know that the developer of Daniel's project in his town and the other town has publicly stated that when everything is in place and they're ready to share the plan and all the benefits and everything else with the two towns will have a vote this fall. If those towns vote no to that project, that developer is going home.
They this is on, the wind project
that's
in
right.
Windham.
And they are on record saying that. I don't know how much more local control you get. Same thing happened in Lowell. Same thing happened in Sheffield. Same thing happened at Georgia Mountain. That's local control. Or do we ever build a project? Do we ever get a do we get a Walmart? Do we get a mall? Do we get a dollar store in downtown New Haven where 100% of the people approve of it? No. But, you know, there hasn't been a whole – they're really documented. When you look at the documentation of the number of people and the times that they have called, the numbers that they've been given to call to complain about turbine sound, it's not a lot of people. But we are responding to it because we don't want anybody – to be uncomfortable or hurt. We are going to find pathways to the solutions for those problems.
But even in your bill, as it's moving through now the House and through your committee, Representative Klein, you say that the Public Service Board would be required to have some standards for noise for wind right. turbines and then also look on an individual project basis.
Right.
But you're still not going to satisfy everybody. And in some cases where right now all of the ruling parties have said the noise levels are acceptable, you still have people who live near these projects
correct.
Who say it's not, and I still believe it is making me sick.
Right, right. Well, we're not going to reach back, okay? But I know that we're asking some of the folks to have conversations with people who feel aggrieved and maybe come to some sort of solutions. You know, you can, you know, if people are so, if it's so terrible, you know, the developer should buy their house.
All right. Well, we're going to wait and see what happens. Representative Tony Klein saying this bill will be out of his committee by the end of the day today as we broadcast here live in the noon hour. So we'll wait and see what happens with that. I want to thank you both for being on the program. Senator Chris Bray, chair of the Senate Natural Resources and Energy Committee, and Representative Tony Klein, chair of the House Natural Resources and Energy Committee.
And Jane, can I jump in for 10 seconds?
10 seconds. You got it.
Tony Klein is retiring after 14 years in the legislature, and he has been a thoughtful, incredibly hardworking person who's moved renewable energy forward, and Vermonters owe him a great debt of gratitude.
Well, so we have some kudos here from your colleague in the legislature, Tony
Klein. Probably get a lot of hate mail now.
Well, thanks very much to both of you. And I will say we'll put a link up to the Bill Tracker website. So if anybody wants to see what this bill looks like as it moves through committees and as it was passed by the Senate, you'll find it on our Facebook page. Thanks very much to both of you.
Thank you. And thank you, Chris.
Thank you.
Welcome back to Vermont Edition. I'm Jane Lindholm. The Reserve Officer Training Corps, ROTC, turns 100 today. It was created by an act of Congress in 1916 when the U.S. was on the precipice of joining World War I and needed well-trained officers. ROTC programs run on college campuses across the country. Students who receive these scholarships get a full ride to their college. In exchange, they go through rigorous officer training and commit to serving in the armed forces after graduating. Norwich University is the birthplace of ROTC. This idea of combining civilian college life with military officer training started there well before the official ROTC program started. And today and tomorrow, Norwich is hosting a symposium to honor ROTC's 100th anniversary. Our producer, Patty Daniels, shares this visit to campus.
The president of Norwich University, Admiral Richard Schneider, is brimming with energy. Highly decorated officers from all branches of the U.S. military are descending on campus this week.
I have got other 4 stars here, 3 stars, 2 stars, and 1 star. So it's a cast of stars everywhere. It could be a protocol disaster, but my staff is very good at this.
Schneider has just spent the afternoon at Norwich's annual Tricolor Service Awards. It's a ceremony where 121 cadets were honored. His dark green dress uniform is impeccable. But he sits comfortably in his large cream-colored office. Bright afternoon light pours in the windows as he describes the 2-day symposium recognizing ROTC's 100th year.
We're not going to be talking about 100 years of glory of producing wonderful officers, which we have in the nation for America. What we're going to be talking about is what should we be teaching these kids today to know what kind of war we're going to be fighting 15 or 20 years from now. And that is a big problem.
ROTC turns 100 today, but Norwich lays claim to being ROTC's birthplace because the idea took shape with the school's founding by Captain Aldrin Partridge in 1819.
The country, which was very young, I mean, think 1776, we fought for our independence, but it was 1819. It wasn't that long. And everybody remembered the threat of the redcoats coming over the green hills of Vermont. And damn it, we needed educated guys to lead troops. Partridge said, listen, educated people need to know how to lead troops in a time of war. And if we're not fighting, we should be building the economy, because if you owe people money, you can't be free. And he basically is given the honor of the father of the citizen soldier, and we are the birthplace of the Reserve Officer Training Corps.
Four of the five U.S. military branches have ROTC programs. Only the Coast Guard doesn't. And Norwich has all four ROTC programs on its campus: Army, Navy, Air Force, Marines. About half of the cadet corps here is ROTC. Schneider says it's about as hard to get an ROTC scholarship these days as it is to get into West Point. The rest of the cadets pay tuition. They pay to get yelled at, he says, not without pride. But civilian students attend Norwich, too.
Having military people and civilian people together, I think, is awesome. And the way we structured Norwich looks just like the Department of Defense. Two-thirds are in uniform and one-third are civilians. And by the way, we do not think the same.
And Schneider says that civilian and military mix creates a huge educational advantage for his future officers. He compares today's Norwich experience to his own years at the Coast Guard Academy in the 1960s.
We were all men. We were all engineers. I'm sure we were all right-wing Republicans. And you couldn't have an argument in class. Now it's totally different. So you can have arguments about why are we fighting in Afghanistan? What does this mean? We didn't have those conversations when you're all thinking the same way.
President Schneider speaks emphatically about the discipline that Norwich demands of its cadets and about molding them into leaders.
Equipment will come and go. Planes change. Armament changes. You know what doesn't change? Human behavior. And you have to hold on to what's critically essential to lead other people. And the only way you lead people is ethically. You have to have the moral high ground, or you always lose. And it's a great compliment, I think, to the school, to its founder, to our principles, to our values, that we produce kids who want to serve. That's what we do.
Reserve Officers Association Award, Department of Vermont. Cadets in junior or senior class who demonstrate outstanding qualities of leadership, moral character, and high aptitude for military service. Presented by Brigadier General Tom O'Donovan.
The fierce pride that Schneider has for his cadets was on full display earlier in the afternoon during the Tricolor Service Awards. Plumlee Armory was filled with hundreds of uniformed cadets in crisp white shirts. Many of their shoulders are decorated with braided gold cords. They sat attentively, maybe occasionally bored, as their peers received awards for scholarship, service, and upholding ROTC values. Four of those ROTC students met with me afterwards to talk about why they chose the military. Cadets Michael Heimel and Emily Hart are both in the class of 2016. Graduation is just around the corner for them. Annalise Henney is a junior, and Eric Rajunas is a sophomore. Heimel's background is military all the way. He's the 14th member of his family to attend Norwich. He grew up on military bases. Hart, Henney, and Rajunas all had military influences from parents or grandparents. But maybe Cadet Henney from New York City is the outlier.
I went to an all-girls Catholic high school in Manhattan, so this is a very different experience.
What they have in common is a desire to serve. They speak about this earnestly, without reservation about their patriotism. And they say they are not unique. Here's Cadet Hart.
Even when I was young, I always felt like I had a need to serve. My dad was in the Army as a specialist, and he went around with his camera, and he was actually a radio guy, too. And he would go interview all these soldiers right before they deployed, and he would tell us about it. It struck something in me that I had something to give back. But when you talk to your other friends, like especially high school friends that, you know, went to an art college or, better yet, you know, went on to serve missions and other philanthropic things, You find that you have a lot in common in the fact that you still want to serve your community somehow, so it's not too different. but you just want to do it in a different, more structured way.
And that structure can be grueling. President Schneider described the daily routine to me, and so did the cadets.
The freshmen, you're waking up 5 days a week at 5:30 in the morning.
The Corps of Cadets gets up around 5:30 in the morning. They go PT. That's physical training. And the day starts then.
I'm on the swim team, so I practice. I swim at 5:30 every morning to 7 o'clock.
They have breakfast at 7 o'clock.
You have to have your beds made, showered, hygiene, all that stuff, and ready for the day.
Make sure the uniform's looking good. Make their bed, shine their shoes.
Then formation starts.
Formation, which is at 0730.
We raise the colors of the United States of America. We render honors to the nation, and then we go to class at 8 o'clock.
The freshmen just live to be an upperclassman because they're like, oh my gosh, I can finally take a nap.
And that's just the first few hours of the day. From morning to night, first-year cadets have very little flexibility in their schedules. The older cadets say that theoretically they have more free time, but it evaporates with more ROTC responsibilities and harder classes. Occasionally, these students let slide that being here at Norwich, trying to fulfill the demands placed on them, it gets to everyone at some point.
Sometimes you're not happy to be here, but when you leave this place, you're like, this was the place to be. Exactly. This was the place to be.
Because everybody's thought about transfer.
Exactly.
Everybody's thought about it. Yeah. Just once. Not even in a bad way. Not that it's a bad place. It's a great place. But, you know, through any adversity, you're just like, if you have the ability to end it, some people do. And some people just leave. But, I mean.
But joking aside, the two seniors at the table, cadets Emily Hart and Michael Heimel, are getting a clearer picture of their lives after Norwich. Cadet Hart will go to training in Arizona. She's going to be a military intelligence analyst. And if all goes according to plan for Cadet Heimel, late next fall, he'll be leading a platoon of 40 soldiers.
My brother is an enlisted man. He did not go to college. He joined the Army out of high school. And he's got one combat deployment. The thing that I try and do the most and I think about often is how I'm going to be a leader to individuals like my brother. And it certainly adds a personal aspect of it, but it's something that I feel that I need to dedicate more time to really studying and figuring out how to apply.
Graduation for ROTC students also means they are commissioned as officers. And that is the moment that Cadet Heimel is focused on.
It's the moment that I've always imagined. I'm going to have my father swearing me and giving me my oath. I'm going to have my grandfathers, both of them, Norwich alumni, putting on my lieutenant bars. My brother will be my first salute as an enlisted man. And so to me, the military traditions, just the lifestyle and the brotherhood and the fraternity and the life that I'm going to be entering, it's priceless to me. It means so much to me to have my entire family there. I mean, essentially joining a family business at that point. It's been the most poignant image in my mind that has probably gotten me through the past 4 years.
I had asked these cadets at one point, what do civilians misunderstand about life in ROTC? A little later in the afternoon, Cadet Rejunas found me on campus and said he'd been thinking about that question and he wanted to share this story.
For me, being openly gay was definitely not sure how received I would be. And I was went into the closet for a little while here, even though I was out in high school, just to kind of get a feel for the waters, so to speak.
Rejunas says it was early in his first year when his platoon mates found out that he was gay, and they were supportive. They told him they'd have his back if someone gave him grief. Fast forward to last weekend when the big event on campus was a formal, the junior ring ball.
And I was planning to take somebody from another school, another guy, and I was, stood up. So I was, a little down, and I was talking to one of my friends about it just candidly. You know, he'd asked about, him coming up, and I said it wasn't happening anymore and how I was got stood up embarrassingly. You know, without hesitation, he said, I'll take you. You know, just this straight other, young cadet that was just a good friend of mine and just being a good friend. And, he took me and, we had a great time together. And it was so well received. Like everybody, was coming up to us and who had heard, just by word of mouth. It's a small school. News travels fast and everyone was just so positive. And it's just something, just a testament to how progressive the institution is.
Cadet Rejuna says he doesn't know yet if the Army will treat him the way Norwich does, but he hopes it will, and he's full of optimism and ease about his choice to be here. As we finish talking, we walk outside, and long shadows are falling across the parade ground. It's nearing 5 o'clock in the afternoon, and cadets march in the daily ceremony to lower the American flag. For VPR News, I'm Patty Daniels in Northfield.
Mm. Norwich University is marking the 100th anniversary of ROTC with a two-day symposium on campus. Many events are open to the public, including an address this evening by U.S. Army Chief of Staff General Mark Milley. Tomorrow afternoon, NPR's Pentagon reporter Tom Bowman moderates a panel on the future of the ROTC. We have a link with details at vpr.net/Vermont Edition. We talked earlier this hour about the energy siting bill and whether there's time for it to pass before the legislature adjourns. It's not the only bill facing that question. Tomorrow on Vermont Edition, join us for a reporter's roundtable and get a status report on key pieces of legislation and revisit some of the twists and turns at the State House this session. That's tomorrow at noon. Vermont Edition is produced by Rick Singeri and Sam Gail Rosen, with production assistance from Anna St. Marie. Liam Connors directed the show, and our executive producer is Patty Daniels. I'm Jane Lindholm. Thanks for listening.